Well, it is a great pleasure this afternoon at the Curzon Bloomsbury to meet James Grimrod. And James, of course, we were at Lampeter together, but
we were.
I don't think we necessarily knew at the time that we were at Lampeter at the same time.
No, I recognise your face, so I must have seen you around as one of the sort of Lampeter characters.
Yeah.
But I don't think we knew each other at the time, although we have friends in common.
We do, and of course we've met at the London Branch dinner that meets every May.
Yes.
And do you want to say when you were at Lampeter and what you did?
I was at Lampeter from 1993 to 96, initially to do something called informatics, philosophy and informatics. But by the second year I'd converted to doing single honours history, and that's what I graduated in.
Well, you're not the only person, maybe the first person I've interviewed, but certainly not the first person I've known who did informatics. A friend of mine did informatics and theology, but actually has used the informatics part of his degree and not the theology, whereas I did straight theology, and of course I've obviously used that in my profession. But how interesting that you started on a journey and a different outcome followed. But we did overlap as undergraduates then, because
yes.
I was 91 to 94. So do you want to say a little bit about what you do now?
I work for University College London as an administrator.
Are you somebody who looks back on the degree that you did, the time that you were there? Do you see any kind of stepping stones? I mean, it's easy in retrospect, I do that, to sort of think, maybe because my degree was in an area where I've continued to work, so there's an obvious sort of continuum. But have you found that the degree that you did in Lampeter all those years ago has kind of impacted on the life and the career that you followed?
I don't know whether it's impacted on my choice of career, but it's certainly impacted on my life and maybe the decisions I make day to day, both at work and in my private life. I think that's one of the great things about learning, is that it doesn't just give you windows onto new worlds. It gives you windows onto new ways of thinking and seeing things. Yes, I certainly look back at the history I did at Lampeter, and there are elements of that that really do impact, because even something quite silly, like when I did the making of medieval France with Malcolm Hogg, and that was fascinating because I'd never realised quite how much of the Roman Empire was left, how much it had it impacted on what came after it and remained. And you might think, well, how does that affect anything that comes up after it for me? And it was just a way of seeing the deeper time, I suppose, and the connections to the past, which you as you get older, you start building anyway, I think. But that was a real kind of eye-opening moment, because up until that point, I think I'd seen history as disconnected.
Do you know, one of the things I find is that when the things that have happened since you went to university end up being on the syllabus of what children are studying. I mean, when I was at school, we were doing the Second World War. So I was at school, obviously, in the 1980s. And I think there was one project where we were asked to interview our grandparents to talk about their wartime experiences. So it was living history. But, you know, subsequent to that, I remember we did the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1961. And this was at a time when, you know, the same president was still in control as he was for many years after that in Cuba. And it's one of those things you're thinking, but how can we be studying something that's almost like a little bit too contemporary? It's still, you know, the implications of that haven't sort of been properly processed. We haven't moved on from that. And I'm sure that if it isn't happening already, Brexit is being studied or will be studied on the, for all we know, the primary school curriculum. So you've got those sort of things. But I also think that one thing that I've learned is that history is something that is always sort of ongoing, in the sense that at different periods, we have different political compositions. that there's always a sense that something makes a particular era back in vogue. And, yes. And having that awareness, being able to join those dots, you mentioned the Romans, for example, just now, is actually quite useful, but it's never in the way that you might think of it. You never know, you know, depending on the composition of the next American government, the next president, or whoever it might be.
Yes, I think, again, this is something that comes with age, and one of the things that's happened since leaving full-time education, for me, is it's that great joy in realizing that learning is something that doesn't just stop at the end of your full-time education. And there isn't, I think, because we have this institution of education from, you know, the age of 3 to the age of 21 or more, you tend to think of education as being something that happens at a particular point in your life. And the great thing about adulthood is one of the benefits of adulthood is that the joy of being able to learn in your own time and learn the things you want, and to realise that you can still carry on learning. And I've learned a lot in my post-university days, particularly when it comes to the idea that, or the realisation, I suppose, that history is not what happens to get us to the point when we exist. You know, we are not the culmination of history. And it hasn't, all of the events that have happened so far haven't happened in order for us to be able to do what we do. And that it's that connection, it's that realization that you're part of something that is ongoing, that doesn't stop. The realization as well is that the things that have happened are not, we're not, it's coming back to this idea of the history being disconnected from us, whereas actually, as we can see now in Israel-Palestine, for example, you know, history is, this is, you know, where do you start with the history of Israel-Palestine? You know, you can go back thousands of years potentially. But I think we have really, our generation in particular, probably thought up until about 10 years ago, or maybe more, until about 2008-09, that we were living in an era where things were just getting better. And that, I think, enhanced that feeling that history was there for us and that we were the culmination of this.
It's almost like the omega point, almost, the sort of sense that this is all we're leading to a goal.
It's all leading to us.
And that goal is suddenly going to mean that we can stop.
Yes.
You know, like those robots in the sort of, you know, early 20th century animation.
Yes.
Somehow, actually, they were going to take on the human role.
Yes, yes.
And we were going to have this wonderful recreational-led future.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't
quite
happen.
And actually, what we discovered, you know, I mean, there were plenty of people saying this was not the case then, of course, but it was too easy to ignore it. And then you have the crash of 2008-09 and all of the events that happened after that. Then you end up eventually with Trump and with Brexit and with the rise of the Putin, or rather Putin turning into the enemy of the West rather than an ally of the West. And suddenly, you know, the rise of the right wing, the rise of ideas that we thought had been put to bed. You know, suddenly Roe versus Wade is overturned in the United States. You realise then that these ideas were not put to bed and we hadn't moved on and it wasn't a straight line and things can turn full circle. And again, going back to history, I remember reading a history of Ukraine before the current situation, and it described how I can't remember which Tsar it was, it might have been Catherine the Great, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth at its height controlled a huge swathe of land from Lithuania all the way down to almost to the southern part of what is now Ukraine. But the Grand Duchy of Muscovy wanted to expand its power, And in order to do that, it infiltrated a lot of the nobles, a lot of the landowning aristocrats of the sort of south and eastern parts of the empire, and were able to, on the basis of going in to defend them, invade and take over a huge chunk of the Grand Duchy's Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania. And that was that's what Russia has always done. Of course, it's drawing patterns where there aren't necessarily patterns, and it's not necessarily the case that that's just what Russians do. But it's remarkably similar.
Yeah, but there's also an angle, because I came across a picture recently. Well, I saw the picture recently. Of when I was 5, and there's a picture of me and my sister on the steps of Downing Street.
Yes.
Now, obviously, back then it was possible to walk up down, unimaginable now.
Yes.
But of course, it then occurred to me that the present incumbent at number 10 wasn't even born. He was born, I think, in 1980. So suddenly all the sort of parallels that I draw on from, you know, the first time I voted was in 1992. So the things that I can remember, the things I can draw on, the kind of, obviously, political experience from reading and watching and listening and, you know, reading bits of Hansard or whatever it might be, you know, is something that the present Prime Minister doesn't have. I mean, he has a different sense because he obviously has access to the top civil servants, cabinet ministers, all the wealth of experience that they bring. But again, it just shows how perspectival these things are. And I suppose that it begs the question, is somebody who's relatively young better or worse for that kind of role than somebody who, like a Ken Clark figure, who, you know, who had decades of experience and was still, you know, angling for a top job, or a Joe Biden is a very concrete example. He did get the presidency after 2 previous failed bids at the job, and became president in his very late 70s and is seeking re-election at what will be 82. So I look back on this and think, well, it's like with my nostalgia podcast. I always thought at the beginning, if I interview somebody in their early 20s, what are we going to talk about? Because they're too young to talk about nostalgia. How wrong I was. Because I was naively thinking that if I interview somebody who's 90, then they're going to have so much to talk about. But of course, some people are very good at being critically reflective.
Yes.
Some people are very happy to talk about their past, whether it's 5 years ago or 85 years ago. So at the end of the day, there's no sense that there is sort of an optimum, like this person is right and that person isn't right, simply on account of the sort of experience that they've accrued.
I mean, I would say in terms of nostalgia, I can remember from, I think all my life, I've been very nostalgic. I've always been quite a sentimental person, and would just become attached to all sorts of objects or places. Quite ordinary, you know, we might go on holiday and I might be quite sort of anxious about leaving home and as a small child and staying somewhere, but by the end of the week that we'd been staying in the hotel or wherever, I would have become attached to that place. I'd be quite sad to leave.
Yeah.
So I think that feeling, certainly for some people, is very strong, and probably isn't something that grows with. I don't know whether I don't think it grows with time. I think it might, you know, it takes on a slightly different colour as you get older. But it's. I think if you're a nostalgic person, you've probably always been nostalgic and liable to look back. You know, the heights from which you can look back are a little bit higher the older you get.
No, you're right, and you just encapsulated something for me, because I remember going on holiday in 1985 to St Ives, and I was only, well, I was probably 11 actually, going on 12, because it was in the May half term, and I remember we stayed at a B&B, and I came away from that really missing the family who'd run the B&B, and it was more like, oh, we're not going to see them again. I think my parents were like, well, you know, sort of. I think they didn't quite sort of necessarily sort of see it. Although, you know, as a young person, I suppose it was, you know, there's been this attachment for 4 or 5 days. But a place that seemed magnificent. Now, I went back to St Ives in 2019, And I remember thinking, okay, my memory is that the sea, you know, the sea was blue and the sky was very blue and the beaches were very long and vast. And I thought, just to sort of see how it squares up all these years later. Actually, it did largely square up, except that it was very beautiful. However, cobbled streets, very narrow. And I remember thinking, it was beautiful, it was, so it matched my memory.
Yeah.
But also I seem to remember, you know, trying to drive around there and just thinking, no, actually, this just doesn't work because it's almost like there are too many people in a place that's too small and doesn't quite accommodate them. So I saw things as an adult, different from perhaps I saw at the age of 11, but widely I could see what my 11-year-old self would have found attractive in this. So I think, what do you think about being nostalgic? I think it kind of says something about somebody's character, rather than the idea that somehow, and of course you can be nostalgic, which is not the same thing as having a recollection of the past, because you can know the dates. You can say this happened, you know, it's like the O-level versus the GCSE syllabus. There's the sort of the knowing the facts of history versus the sense of being able to critically assess. And I think that the nostalgic element, in a way, is one which often is probably frustrating for historians, and we can talk about that, because in a way there's the compositing of events, the sense of like, oh, it was all wonderful in those days, when actually the records from the day, from the diaries or the newspapers or whatever, might actually paint a different picture.
Or the reverse, actually. You might think, oh, this was just, everything was terrible in this particular period and place. But then read those letters and those diaries, you realise that people were just sort of getting on with things, and there was a lot of, you know, love and laughter and happiness and all the rest of it going on in a time that you might otherwise think was pretty dreadful. So I think that's one of the complications, isn't it, that we do imprint our initial impression of the past is through our own prejudices, whichever way that takes it. But that's why history is important, because you can try and get to what, I don't think you can ever be objective entirely, but you can try and get closer to a more nuanced impression of what the situation was.
But there's a question there as to whether it matters, because for somebody who, I mean, Christmas is a good example. If somebody is convinced that the Christmases past were wonderful and that suddenly we have lost something in the years or the decades since, there's, you know, even if you come up with evidence, you know, what's that going to mean? You say, oh yes, you're quite right. My memories were actually all distorted. Yes. Thank you for putting me straight. Yes. You know, it doesn't work that way.
No, and even, you know, before you started recording, we were talking about the Second World War and comparing it to the pandemic. And I think, that's a really good example of really awful period, and it was terrible suffering, and millions of people died and were seriously injured and all the rest of it. But there was, you know, there was also a lot of people will have happy memories of that time, because there were things that, particularly in this atomized world where we live in these, very often people live on their own now, or they live in a small family group. There's an epidemic of loneliness. And I think that we should underestimate quite the power of coming together for making people feel good. I think in something like the Second World War, alongside the terror and the horror and the sheer awfulness of it, and the fact that it carried on day after day after day after day for 6 years, there were these experiences and feelings that were genuinely positive for people, coming together for the sake of everybody, for the sake of the nation, but nation not in an abstract sense, but in sense of all the people that everything we care about. And so you could, I think, as your grandparents, you know, meet and get together, and it could be quite, you know, it might have been difficult at the time, and looking back on it might be unrealistic in terms of how things really were at the time. But that doesn't necessarily invalidate the positive feelings about that situation.
No, and I feel that I'm doing two things at once, because I'm fascinated by, and also very guilty as charged, of the whole nostalgia sort of mindset. And yet I keep a diary, and that diary is a corrective against some of the putting the past on the pedestal that I know I'm guilty of doing.
Yeah.
But in some cases, of course, you'll read a diary entry and you'll think, oh, actually, that, you know, the thing that I'm remembering from a particular era did not carry the sort of weight at the time. I may not even have mentioned it in the diary, but I'm looking back on it through a different sort of lens.
Yeah.
However, there are times when it completely dovetails and the recollection and the, everything that was going on around it sort of matched. And that, then there's that sense of vindication, because I suppose the worst thing that could happen, for me anyway, would be to learn that, that something that I remember fondly, that I associate with an era, actually didn't happen in the way that I remember. Because I suppose I'm somebody, it's like, you know, I enjoy alcohol, but there's a point where I want to have some fairly memorable, you know, I want to be able to remember an experience.
Yes.
I don't particularly want to sort of not know. I don't want to have a blackout and be able to account for 12 hours of my life.
No.
So in the same way, I don't want to go back to 1993 and then suddenly discover I have no recollection of any of that. Or did that actually happen? It could have been somebody else's account.
Yes.
There's a sense that I have some kind of proprietorial, almost sort of, you know, ownership of that kind of thing, because I lived through it and I have an investment in it.
Yes, yes. Yes. And it, well, of course, the difficulty of memory is that, you know, even if you have, you know, take this situation, we're sitting in a cafe now. We were to write down immediately after this as much as we could remember about this situation, there would be quite a significant set of differences, because most of the time, most people aren't paying attention to most of the things that are going on around them. It's just how the brain works. And so there's no particular reason why you know you can say, well, my memory wasn't accurate, but you could also, because of course as you hold on to memories over time, your brain sort of changes those memories incrementally over time. So they might have been relatively accurate at the start, but you know, 30, 40 years later, they've morphed into something else. But also, you might have taken an incorrect recollection of it at the time. You know, because we're not paying attention to everything. Somebody might say, well, don't you remember this happened?
Yeah.
No idea.
But I found that in those days, when we didn't record lectures, when we were undergraduates, you know, if you had to miss a class for some reason, the normal advice would be, oh, borrow the notes from somebody else, or, you know, write up somebody else's notes.
Yeah.
Which, of course, was often almost laughable, because the person you might ask has done like a spider diagram of the lecture, whereas you might have written something, you know, where you're trying to write everything down that the tutor is telling you. So I look at somebody's graph with lots of arrows and circles and squares and letters or whatever it might be that are meant to signify particular parts of the lecture, and I'm thinking, how is that going to be useful in terms of revising for an exam? So in that sense, you're right that it's not just that some people write more than others, it's actually the way that we remember what we perceive. I mean, isn't it true that the things we most remember often are not the content of a lecture, but you might remember something else going on around it in relation to something inadvertent, or something to do with something that goes wrong,
or
what the lecturer is wearing, or perhaps if there's a dynamic that somebody in the room is hostile, and you think, what was the lecture on? I have no idea, but I remember it vividly.
Yes. Well, that's it. I mean, I remember there was a lecturer in philosophy whose speciality was the ancient Greek philosophers.
This is David Walford.
Yes. And he was a very prim, quite sort of well-dressed, well-spoken, as we would have said then. And he gave a lecture on Socrates, who was his favourite philosopher. And he had everybody on the edges of their seats, spellbound. It was silent, you know, there was just people, you know, you wanted to applaud at the end of it. It was so you know, this person who normally gave all the right lectures, who gave this spellbinding lecture. I can't tell you anything about Socrates that I learned from that lecture, but I can tell you how it made me feel, and I can tell you how it made everybody else feel, because you can see everybody else. Nobody was taking notes.
No, that's right. And so the whole myth of David Walford, and there is a whole mythology around him.
Right.
Ironic, considering he's looking at, you know, Greek myth as part of his, or Greek myth and philosophy. But I always find that, and I've said this in other podcast episodes as well, that we have photographs from that era, but not of the lectures.
No.
I bet you haven't got a photograph of David Walford delivering that lecture, or any other lecture, or even of your friends sitting next to you in the lecture theatre. No. But what you probably, not necessarily you, but what other people will have are records of maybe the student union bar, or more social events when perhaps you let your guard down.
Yes.
So the things that we ostensibly go to university for are not the things we have. And there are obvious reasons for that. Although, as somebody was pointing out to me, if you were at a conference, you put it up on Twitter, you say, look at this person giving this presentation, but we don't have a record of our own university lectures. And I always find that very strange, in a way, that we sort of have records, but they're of the wrong things. Or it's all back to front.
Yes, and also that I see the opposite side as well of the fact that we have, you know, hundreds, thousands of years of no record at all of people's lives, you know. I mean, there are some people, some famous people whose lives we know something about, but we live in a world now where so many things are recorded. The people growing up now will have their whole lives recorded for them, and all the characters of their life will be recorded. And it would be, I think it'll be very, it'll be particularly difficult for them to think what it was like to have significant moments of your life completely unrecorded, significant experiences unrecorded, significant people unrecorded, and even the mundane unrecorded. And that's I mean, I don't know what I think about that. I don't know whether it's an age thing or whether there's something more to it, but I think there is something quite nice in being in the moment and not saying, oh, let me get my camera out, or let me get my phone out, or whatever the device might be at that time. Because I think that breaks the moment.
And you're spot on, because if our lives are documented to that degree, there are obvious gaps. I mean, you know, my children have so much, you know, there's a huge record of their growing up, but there's nothing, of course, of when they're actually in school, which is arguably the most defining thing of their childhood, as in, you know, there's a big thing about which school you go to and whether, you know, how are you prospering. But we don't have a record of that.
Not yet. Because once they get to a certain age, they will pester you into having a phone.
Yeah.
And then they will be recording an awful lot of that, their childhood. And I'm glad I don't have a record of most of my childhood. I think, particularly my teenage years, I think that's going to be a very difficult thing, I think, for a lot of people to cope with. Maybe it'll be so common that it won't matter. But I think, that's something I'm glad I don't have.
Yeah, because when you have a record of those sort of events, I don't know what you do with it all those decades later, if you even have time to sort through all of that, because I was just thinking that, you know, as you were talking about the Socrates lecture, and I, you know, obviously said you are unlikely to have a photograph of the occasion, but if somebody got a camera out, that would have been seen as a violation, or would have drawn undue attention to them.
Very specifically, somebody in one of Dr. Walford's lectures got a recording device out, and he told them to put it away.
Yeah.
You weren't allowed to record the lectures.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't about. And I think this is actually something perhaps we've lost, is that the idea that you're not going to a lecture really to take notes, certainly not in a liberal arts context. Maybe not to take as many notes as perhaps we thought we were meant to be taking. More going to listen. To take it in, and I think it's actually, that's another one of the pleasures of learning as an adult, that you can just listen to a podcast or whatever and take in that information, and you don't have to write notes on it. And I think, although there are other distractions now, of course, you could be listening to a podcast and scrolling through your phone. That's a different kind of distraction.
Yeah, once upon a time that would have been called multitasking, yeah. Of course. But there's something in that, because you mentioned the mundane stuff that often, like in my case, a diary. I mean, if I had my time again, I know I would have written more, because I write ridiculous. I have a diary. I write like 2,000 words a day. Back then, I would just write a couple of lines, and maybe some days when it's like a word, or just maybe some days back in, certainly the very early days at Lampeter, a whole week or so that there's no entry. And it might just be, oh, got my essay mark back, happy with my whatever for Victorian crisis of faith, or whatever the topic or the course might have been. But looking back on that now, sometimes, or at least when I had a casual look through the old diaries, I thought, this is awful, because it's just like, went to the King's Head, went to the cottage garden. In some cases, they might say, had fish and chips or something. And I'm like, how used, you know, of all the things I could have recorded, you know, that's like embarrassing. However, when I reflected on it a bit more, I thought, hang on, this is telling me something about the sort of social world, that I did go to pubs daily. And it would have names in there of people who, in some cases, I may have long since forgotten, or maybe have reconnected with. But it did at least tell me something about the sort of, you know, in a world before mobile phones, in a world before the internet, of something about the composition of the days. The fact that I thought that the most important thing to say was, oh, I had a jacket potato and poos or something, it was more about that. It was more about that was the place to gather and there meet people, have conversations. But at least there was a springboard there. There was something tangible to work with.
And I think when it coming, you know, how it ties in with nostalgia is that one thing that I've learned probably since my mid-30s onwards was that it's the ordinary experiences, the everyday experiences that you have with friends and family, people you love, which are the things that you really look back on and miss. Now, my mother died in 2009, and the memories I have that I treasure aren't the memories of going on holiday, for example. It's not doing something, you know, really expensive or luxurious or unusual, but it's the everyday things. So I remember the first time I bought myself some new bedding, some new sheets for my bed after my mother died, and I thought, that's the sort of thing I would have spoken to her about. And it would have just been a passing comment in a phone call. I would have been like, oh, I got myself some new sheets, and they like this and like the other, and she would probably have said, oh, that sounds nice, and then we'd have moved on to the next thing. It's a very ordinary thing. That's the thing that you really miss. I mean, you could be now nostalgic about things that, about people and places that did exist as well, of course, but just happened a long time ago. So I could be nostalgic about things that I did with my nan, who, touch wood, is still alive. We'd meet every Friday afternoon after, well, she would come to pick me up from school every Friday afternoon, and we'd have an ice cream with two flakes in, and walk home, and then later on somebody would drive us to the fish and chips and pick up some fish and chips. And the ordinary stuff like that is the stuff that really you value much more when you...
Yes, you're right, because I've still got all my old essays, and because I still work in the same sort of profession. I'd often, even when I was preparing lecture notes in the early days when I was teaching, I'd often refer to those as a template, like, oh, you know, I did that research, you know, and it was, you know, I'm not saying I would do that now. But what was interesting is that when you're writing an essay, you're looking for the best, the most important. You know, you look through a book, you think, perfect quote, that sort of is, you know, that's very erudite, and you've got that pithy sentence or something that just looks like it's, you know. But often that notion of counterpoint comes in, because writing an essay, you want something that looks grandiose, you want something that looks impressive. I mean, certainly I'm thinking about my own undergraduate days. You want to impress the tutor. But often the things that really matter, the thing, you know, my own students, I mean, obviously when they're in a lecture theatre or in a seminar room, they will be talking about the particular topic of the week, and they'll often talk about their own experiences and so on. But of course, what I see of them in the lecture theatre, and then what will actually happen outside of that, and what matters to them, those grounding values, those existential, you know, things that matter more than anything else, are not the things you'd write about in an undergraduate essay. So for me, you do need those photographs at the bar when people are drunk, but you need the whole picture. That's the thing. It's potentially having the one-sidedness, the disproportionate emphasis, or maybe on one thing over the other. And maybe I'm over-worrying, because, you know, at the end of the day, is anybody really, you know, to what extent is this going to matter? Is somebody suddenly going to suddenly say, you know, we need this record of 1993, because it's, I mean, they may well do that, and actually I might suddenly say, look, I've got all this written down. But in a way, we don't know what the historians of the future, or indeed ourselves, or our own families, will possibly want, and for what purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I could be very morbid and say, well, immediately afterwards, if we have children, grandchildren, they may want something. But after that, it becomes, I mean, certainly, it would be nice to know more about, you know, great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents, people we don't know who are our ancestors. But I can, you know, I can see it in our family as generations, older generations die off and new generations come up. There is a natural kind of tendency to kind of, not for most people, unless you're sentimental like me, most people don't want to hang on to stuff and look into people's past. It just seems fairly ordinary to be in the time that you're in. So if I was being quite sort of pessimistic, I'd say that there's an most people most of the time won't want anything about us from our past, unless we do something particularly.
There is an adage, isn't there, that you have to be infamous in order to be famous.
Yes.
You know, in order for people to be writing about you or talking about you, it doesn't mean to say that you're a particularly special or remarkable person, but you may have done something that was particularly so awful or newsworthy that people want to read about it. Whereas you might have the most compelling story to tell, but if it's not really something that has sort of caught the news agenda, then really who'd want to publish that? Why would somebody what's so special about you? If you're a prime minister and you do something fairly run of the mill, well, that's going to be more newsworthy than someone like me doing something particularly extraordinary.
Yes.
One thing I haven't asked you is where you grew up.
Oh, right.
A very obvious question, because we've been talking about your Lampeter.
So I'm born and brought up in North London, in Enfield, in Chase Farm Hospital, which has actually been pulled down. There is now a new hospital there, and I went back recently, and for the first time in many decades, and that was quite odd. I walked past the second home that I was brought up in, into the hospital grounds, and I used to get my bus to school from the hospital grounds for 7 years, and it was weird walking those streets again, because now, instead of a few nurses' homes and then the hospital buildings, there were now flats and houses and things, and some of the street pattern was still there from the old days, but a lot of it had gone. And it was strange thinking the place that I was born was no longer there. There's now a school on the site, in fact. And so that was a very strange feeling, going back there after all that.
You're reminding me of the Jack Nicholson film about Schmidt, which was made, 20 years ago now, where he's in Nebraska and he goes back to find his old home.
Yeah.
And actually it's like the forecourt of a shop, really, or like equivalent of like a service station. And he's just standing there thinking, gosh, that's where my front bedroom was or whatever it might be. Yeah. And the man is like, can I help you? Are you having a medical crisis? You know, can I phone somebody? And it's that mismatch between you know, what he's doing, and yeah. the fact that it is of no consequence or seems rather absurd
yeah.
to somebody who's like, well, you know, this is a shop. Do you want to buy anything, sir? I think
it's something to do with how our brains are wired, that we get very attached to a certain space, a certain place in space and time, if you like. Comes of being conscious of being in that space and in that time, and then not being in it, and you can go back to a space. Well, now the new entrance to Tottenham Road tube station is where there used to be a club called the Astoria. And I used to go there most Saturday nights in the early noughties. And that building's completely gone. And every time I go to that station, it's like, well, this is where I used to go be clubbing all those times.
Yeah, and it's worth, well, that's the perfect seg to ask about Lampeter.
Yeah.
Because we may already have had this conversation when we met at those Lampeter branch dinners yes. in London. But have you been back to Lampeter since you graduated?
I went back in about 2000, 2002, something like that. So not for at least 20 years. A part of me is a little bit reticent too, because I don't like. A part of me really doesn't like change. I like to, you know, I like to think that place is as it was, 30, 25, 30 years ago. But no, I've not been back. I'd like to go. I think. And I suspect it's not changed as much as some parts of London that I know, in terms of buildings being pulled down and new things being put in their place. But of course, we had the same room, didn't we?
In Burgess?
Yes.
Okay, we need to...
Yes.
Yeah, so now, the top floor room looking down over Station Terrace.
Looking down Station Terrace.
Route 18, I think it was.
Could have been, yes. I have no recollection of the number, but that's yes. That would be really strange. I don't know whether it still holds. It's probably been sold off now. But
the building is still there.
Yes.
I think it's the polite answer would be that it's dormant.
It's dormant. Yes. Yes. Yeah. But that was yes. My recollection is you would have had it in your first year.
So 91 to 92,
and I had it my first year.
So 93 to 94.
Yeah. And. I can remember this room. I mean, I don't think students would put up with it these days. It was quite bare. And there was two pieces of lino on the floor that didn't quite meet in the middle. But yes, I remember looking down Station Terrace. And at the bottom of Station Terrace is a big hill, which everybody else calls Magic Mountain.
Yes.
Because it's apparently where you can pick up some special mushrooms.
I never went there.
I never went there either. No.
Even though I saw it every morning.
I've never,
and not just every morning, it was in front of me.
All the time, I know. I never went up it.
No.
But I called it Tree Council Hill. Mm. Because it looked to me like all these trees were coming from miles away, meeting in a little clump, a circle at the top for a meeting. This is like the Ents in Lord of the Rings or something. I was always a little bit of a romantic.
Yeah, I mean, I went back, and it took me about 16 years, really, and all sorts of personal reasons as well about the various times. I spent 10 years in Lampeter,
so
in a way, I needed to step properly away before I could go back. But actually, what I found is that it was the people that mattered, and then it was meeting people outside of Lampeter.
Yeah.
And having Lampeter conversations that made me think, it doesn't matter if the place has changed. But actually, I think, you know, nostalgia might be my thing, but I'm not averse to change.
Yes.
You know, I'm not sure I want to preserve the past as it was. I mean, a good example would be, you know, here we're doing a podcast.
Yes.
You know, I'm not going to say, oh, I remember the day before podcasts, oh, they were nice days. I'm thinking, yeah, we didn't have podcasts.
Yeah.
They were nice days in many ways. But now that we have technology, even if we are scrolling on our phones excessively during pandemics and other times, that there are huge benefits.
Yeah.
And it's more that we dealt with the resources that were available to us at the time.
Yeah.
And we have now adapted to what's available to us now.
Yeah.
There's another question about whether our student experiences were better or worse before mobile phones or before laptops.
Yes.
That's a separate point. Yes. But I would never want to change what we've got. But what I do need to have is to preserve and to respect and to as far as possible, concretize that past. So it's there as it was. But seeing Lampeter change, I was surprised at how similar it is, if I'm honest, and how similar meeting people who are now like me, 50 rather than 20, and to genuinely see them, and perhaps even hope they see me, as 20 again. I actually genuinely can't see 50-year-olds as anything other than, you know, as I saw them. I know I'm 50, I know that they're 50. But the conversations we're having show that actually we are simply picking up from where we left off.
That's always a nice thing when you meet up with people that you've not met for a long time. And you can pick up, you know, sometimes you realise that you didn't have very much to talk about. But more often than not, if you could have a good conversation with somebody 30 years ago, you probably could get on with them now, you know. Yes, that's definitely a nice thing to catch up with people that you haven't seen for some time. And actually, the pandemic, I think for a lot of people, there was a 2 or 3 year break in relationships often, and the number of people that I know that I've seen in the last year or so that I hadn't seen for almost 3 years. The time we ended up meeting up again, and these are people that, you know, they don't go as far back necessarily as Lampeter, but I would have seen more regularly before the pandemic, and suddenly there was this 2 or 3 year break in some cases, and that was quite a strange sort of phenomenon to be faced with. Like this sort of black hole in our lives, where the things happened before and things happened afterwards, but there was this gap in the middle.
Yeah, but I'm a believer in that sense of, you know, continuity there. I know during lockdown people thought, all right, we're going to write... actually, there are two things on that. First of all, I remember during lockdown I found that I was busier than ever because I was having to adapt to teaching in a new way. So when I was hearing that people were like so bored or had so much extra time, they were writing diaries of the pandemic. I'm thinking, well, okay, you know, it's just the... For me, it's not so much what did you do during the pandemic for future historians.
Yeah.
It's what did you do before the pandemic and actually looking at, like, on this day in history.
Yeah.
So it's like we went into lockdown on the 23rd of March, 2020. I'm much more interested in what you're doing on that day in 2019, 18, 17, 16, and backwards.
Yeah.
That for me gives a better picture of how life during lockdown changed than somebody saying, oh, I'm hating this or I'm loving it, depending on your point of view. So there needs to be that context. So I think nostalgia and history actually do go hand in hand to a large extent, because you can be nostalgic, but that's not the same as then saying, I want to write off the past. I think there needs to be a sense of some sort of both counterpart and counterpoint available.
Yes. I think one of the great things, again, another thing that you learn kind of, I think for most people probably once they get a bit older, is that you connect with people who are older than you in a different way. And you realise that these are not different people. Your parents and your grandparents, people of their generation, are not almost, I think when you're growing up you see them as a kind of almost a separate species, you know. There's a line dividing you and them, as we were talking about earlier, the line dividing the present and the past. You realise that doesn't really exist. In the same way, the line dividing older generations and younger ones doesn't really exist, because you realise they've had the same sort of experiences as you've had. Yes, of course, in a different way. You know, they wouldn't have had some of the technology that we had when we were growing up. Similarly, you know, your children will have technology that you didn't have when you were growing up. But the same kind of thoughts and feelings and processes and things that are significant and moving, all these sort of happen to, and all some of the worries and everything else that we experience, the struggles we experience, these have been the same for all time. That's a really great revelation sort of come to. I mean, maybe I was a bit slow, but I think again probably by sort of mid to late 30s I was kind of sort of discovering that. And I remember thinking again about my nan, After my mother died, I realized or understood for the first time all of these people, all these older people around me, have all suffered loss like the loss I've just had. Some of them, like my nan, multiple people. You know, she'd lost her parents, you know, sister, you know, husband, and all sorts of friends over the years. And she was carrying all of that, and had been carrying all of that for most of the time that I'd known her. And, you know, she was, you know, carrying on. So all of these people around me are carrying these this sort of
the weight of loss,
the weight of loss. Mm. Yes, as well as, you know, the good memories and everything else as well. But that was a real, like, oh, okay, now I get, I felt like I connected a lot, not more with other people.
And I think that comes back to something that I think we were saying it before we started recording about, you know, looking back, you know, did people go to the theatre in the First World War? Yes, they did. Did they go to the theatre during lockdown? No, they didn't. But it's the sense that we all carry with us, at the same time, lots of different conflicting needs, responsibilities, worries, anxieties, that, you know, you can be mourning the loss of a family member, but you still have to put food on the table, so you have to go out to work, or you have, you know, you have to pay your electricity bill, you have to, whatever the responsibilities are. So life kind of goes on. And I think that sometimes it's hard, and maybe that's why the diary and other forms is important, because otherwise, we don't know how they managed. Do we think they were just stoical? Is it that somehow they managed better in those days? Well, of course, it depends on the person. But how would we know other than speculation? Because I remember I was lucky to have grandparents alive, certainly my grandfather alive, when I was well into my 40s, or certainly early 40s. You mentioned your 101-year-old grandmother. The last person I interviewed in Canterbury as a 105-year-old grandmother who was born at the end of the First World War. So you have this sort of living history. But I think it's very easy to think, well, if you remember your grandparents as I do, you know, I particularly remember them in their 60s and 70s and so on, and you don't know what it was like for them to grow up, to bring children into the world during the Second World War, and have all those uncertainties ahead of them. Because when I knew them, of course, there was a sense of stability that, you know, I knew them many decades, and they seemed older people, you know, then, and therefore it's hard to imagine them as, you know, dealing as, you know, hard to imagine them as being the age that I was. Now, you know, I'm 50. Well, I think I was in my, when I was born, my grandparents were in their early 50s, so I'm almost the age that they were when I was born. So in that sense, that has to have some effect on the way that I see or think back on them.
Yes, absolutely. It does. And I think this is something that you kind of realise how much time and life experience does matter. It's a temptation when we're young to think, well, you know, I'm intelligent, I'm sensitive, I can see how things are, surely. You realise actually, you know, when people say something like, oh, you don't know what it's like to have a child until you have a child, and I would always think, well, I'm intelligent, I'm a fairly sensitive person, I'm sure I can work it out, I'm sure I can put myself into their shoes. And then something really traumatic, like the loss of my mother, it could be a positive thing, like having children, whatever. Something like that happens, and then you realise, oh, no, I didn't know what that was. I didn't really know what it was like to have that experience until that experience had happened. And that makes you appreciate life experience more than you did before, because you realise you can intellectually know something, but you don't really know it at some kind of almost spiritual level until you experience it.
That said, though, even though I do have children, there's a lot about the growing up that I've kind of maybe deliberately bracketed out. Maybe, you know, sometimes, particularly because I've got more than one, and you know how sometimes, you know, children can be difficult, and they, and therefore somebody might say to me, so how did you manage at a certain point? And I'm like, what did they do, or where did you take them, or what food did you give them? I do keep a diary, and I suppose the diary has some of this sort of information in it, but I'm genuinely drawing a blank. And I think I've just kind of, maybe a lot of it is traumatic. You know, children are, you know, trying to balance that with a job and trying to balance it with sort of all the other life events.
Yeah.
And in a way, if I didn't have the diary, I think I'd really struggle to be able to pinpoint, like, at what point did they start moving on to solids, or how did you manage on car journeys, and so on.
And that's something like, I think that's quite refreshing. I wouldn't want to turn things back in terms of attitudes to children, but I think, or life, but it's quite refreshing when you hear an older person say something like, well, we didn't really think about things like that in those days. I'm like, well, yeah, maybe it doesn't matter if we haven't recorded when, you know, our children first started to walk or whatever. It's nice, but it's not. Maybe it doesn't matter as much as we think it matters, you know. And it probably matters more that we're spending time with them really, you know, it's easy to be distracted by life and stuff. And particularly these days, it's easy to be distracted by the devices that we carry around with us. And I think it's probably more important to be just with the child and experiencing them in the moment rather than necessarily recording.
I always find the context interesting. When I think of a certain day, like it might be the day that one of my children started to walk, but the diary would also record all the other things going on. What was happening in the news? What was I listening to in the car on the way to work? Was I in the midst of a batch of essays? If so, what was the course? You know, wow, that many students were taking that module at that time. You know, all these sort of things go on. So that the walking might have happened at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing. But there were plenty of other things going on that day, which also at least contextualise that. Because if I take that out of context, you know, and it may be that I was there, maybe I wasn't there, maybe I was at a conference, or maybe I was upstairs marking some essays, or I was late at work, coming home from work. You know, there's all these things which somehow make that event give it some more flavour than that's when they started walking.
Yeah.
But of course, the child's perspective, well, they're not going to remember the day they started walking. But the perspective of the siblings or of the mother, or, you know, all need to be factored in. And what may be the most important event for one may actually be an easily forgettable fact for the other, and vice versa.
Yes, because certainly we don't remember our first steps, do we? I think the things that start to become significant are probably slightly older in our lives, aren't they? Going to school, particularly, you know, going to infant school or junior school or whatever, those moments are, I think we remember those events. Although it is interesting, as I've got older, there are certain things which I think a couple of decades ago I would have thought would be memories I would hold on to for life, but there are some memories now that I go to find it and I can't find it anymore. It's like, oh, I've just completely forgotten that name or that place. Or that. I know it's happened. I know I did. I know that I used to remember it, but it's gone now.
Yeah, I went through a period of writing up all my old diaries. So in about 2013, 20 years after I was at university, I started writing up those old diaries and annotating them, and I could remember things from that period, which I, in italics, was adding to the diary. So I wasn't changing anything, but I was just adding to it and making it clear that this was an addendum. But now, when I read back on some of that stuff that 10 years ago I added, I can't remember that.
No.
And I'm thinking, hang on, I am writing something very specific that I believed happened on that day, having gone back over the original entry. So now I'm thinking, it's not that I can't remember what happened in 1993.
Yes.
I can't remember what I thought in 2013 I had done in 1993. Yes. And part of me then just thinks I just have to step away. Because there comes a point where, it's like you were saying about the grief or the mourning of a family member. There are multiple layers that are being piled on.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. It does make you, again, you kind of understand then how, take the example of the Bible, for example. We look at the New Testament, and the first bit of that was written was probably somewhere between 50 and 75 years after Christ died. I think now, imagine something happening in your 20s or 30s.
and then being in your 70s or 80s and writing it down, you really do have a realization of how unlikely it would be that you would have remembered exactly how things were. Even if this was something that was hugely significant, would you really remember all the details? Would you remember all the salient details? Would you remember them in the right order? Would you remember them, the context around them? You know, it's like all these things after 50 years, it's got to be, especially if it's a second-hand account.
Yeah.
It's not the person, but the person's child that's writing it down.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if the podcast is a corrective against some of that, to make sure that you have a more immediate sort of sense of that history. Not deliberately to try and combat that problem of the historical Jesus, but it's an important point about if there is a gap, how do we potentially address that if we think it's worth doing, and for whom might it be important?
I think it's important for people to know that that's that there isn't a black and white. It's not that there isn't an objective fact. I don't want to sound like I'm going down that route, but there are definitely things in life that are grey and that are like, when, this, but also this, and I think that's a really important thing. That, you know, we have to accept that a lot of life is grey and messy and muddled up, and two people who are very close to each other can have completely different recollections of the same event or something, and it doesn't invalidate either of them, really. Yes, I think that's an incredibly important part of
Well, I've got one more question for you, which is the question I always ask at the end of the interview, but it seems actually quite pertinent in terms of the strand that we're carrying on, which is whether you, James, would consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Well, I think relating to what I've just said, I think that's not a dichotomy that I think I can engage with. In that, but I'm definitely somebody who is very sentimental and has to stop myself from wallowing in nostalgia and things like that, because it's easy to pick at the wound, if you like. Because it is like a physical wound. You know, you can't help picking that scab because it feels good, even though it hurts. And I think there's a certain element of that mentally. But of course, you can look forward and find. I mean, this is going to make me sound like a really pessimistic person. I'm very well aware of this. But you can look forward, and also, like at the moment, I think. I'm very pessimistic about the humanity's inability to really grapple with the climate crisis, which is potential, and also the huge species loss. That's a huge catastrophe in itself. And so, whether you're looking forward or back, you can be positive and negative. It's not necessarily the case that if you look back, you're a negative person, and if you look forward, you're a positive person. I think. In that sense, I'm kind of. Am I a backwards or a forwards person? I don't think I can simply answer that. I think,
No, and it's a naughty question to me, because I'm somebody who hates binaries.
Yes.
But I ask a binary question, but the answers. I've done 180 or so of these interviews, and I've got 180 different answers. But that's a very thoughtful, considered answer. So thank you so much, and thank you, James, for being my guest this week.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.